great pleasure indeed at this time to introduce my good friend, the man I love and admire, Dr. Revelo Oliver. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I assume that you have all heard the story of the traveling salesman who, reaching a large city, went to the best barber shop and went down the barber shop till he found an empty chair and relaxed in the chair and asked the barber to give him the works. And of course, the shoeshine boy, I guess it wouldn't be legal under the United Nations Charter to mention his car, went to work on the shoes, and a very pretty young girl started to work on his fingernails. And he looked at the manicurist and thought this was a very attractive little dish. So after a while he said, "Honey, after this let's get together and have some fun." And she looked at him and said, "Oh no, I can't. My husband wouldn't approve." "Oh, come now, honey," he said. "You can surely get away from that big lummox for an evening, can't you?" She said, "No, I'm afraid I can't." He said, "Look, all you've got to do is think up some kind of story that will get the old dope to relax for the evening. You can tell him you're going out to see your sick aunt or something like that." She said, "Well, sir, that would be very difficult. Why don't you tell him he's shaving you?" Well, ladies and gentlemen, I deeply appreciate the very high honor that you have bestowed on me by asking me to appear before you again. I congratulate you on this, your 15th annual meeting. For as conservative and anti-communist societies come and go in this country, your record of 15 years of courageous and continuous activity makes you one of the oldest of the strictly patriotic organizations. I mean, of course, those that are exclusively patriotic and are not either partly social, such as the Daughters of the American Revolution, or specifically religious, such as the many Christian anti-communist organizations. I salute you above all because you have remained together, steadfastly pursuing your purposes and not permitting yourselves to be distracted and disrupted by the powerful, insidious, and seductive pressures that are invariably exerted upon every anti-communist organization that becomes in any way effective. During the past 40 years, I should estimate, rough guess, that perhaps 1,000 anti-communist groups of more than purely local scope have been formed in the United States. Almost all of them have been ephemeral. I suspect that most of them did not last even so long as 4 years. All of them started with bright and usually extravagant hopes of saving the nation in short order. And most of them, in very short order, came to an inglorious end, almost always disintegrating from internal dissension. 35 years ago, for example, there was a large and rapidly growing anti-communist organization of truly national scope, the Paul Revere's. It had many prominent members, adequate finances, and an excellent plan of organization. The members formed local chapters that met each month and were visited from time to time by a representative from the home office in Chicago. I have never been able to learn exactly how many chapters there were, but the Paul Revere chapters were located throughout the country, from Boston to San Diego, and included, I have been told, every state in the Union. The Paul Revere's had many prominent members, but two real leaders. The head of the organization was Colonel Edwin Marshall Hadley, a distinguished patriot well known for two excellent books, Sinister Shadows and TNT, both issued by a publishing subsidiary, the Tower Press in Chicago. Both books deal with the one communist operation that Colonel Hadley correctly recognized as the conspiracy's most strategically important offensive against the American people. That is to say, the Bolsheviks' patient, covert, and insidious infiltration of American colleges and universities for the purpose of systematically poisoning and paralyzing the minds of American youth, and most especially, the minds of future teachers on all levels, from kindergartens to graduate schools. Colonel Hadley was a competent author and able speaker, well qualified to head the Paul Reveres. But he was a man who had neither talent for nor interest in the multiple details of organization and administration that must be attended to if any society is long to endure. The second leader of the Paul Reveres, therefore, was in many ways more indispensable to the organization than the colonel himself. She was a young lady, a very young lady, well-born and comparatively wealthy, vivacious and charming, beautiful and brilliant, of assured social position, and well-known to the general public as a highly talented musician. It was she who kept the Paul Reveres running with her energy and dedication. She supervised the central office, was most active in visiting the local chapters throughout the nation, and, under their auspices, made innumerable speeches to audiences in many towns and cities. Now, the trouble started in a chapter in San Diego. I have no idea who was right. I do not know the details, for I have heard several versions of the affair. But very soon, the members in San Diego were pulling one another's hair. Everyone forgot about the communist conspiracy. Why fight the Bolsheviks when you could have an exhilarating row right at home? The little affair in San Diego would probably have had no effect on the national organization had the leadership of it remained united in purpose. But the burning question that confronted that leadership was simply this. Had or had not Colonel Hadley been guilty of making remarks that were, by innuendo, disparaging to God's chosen people, the Jews? Now let it be clearly understood that I am not discussing tonight the question of the origins, whether religious or historical, of anti-Jewish sentiments either in the United States at the present time or throughout the world during the past 3,000 years. I am not expressing or implying any opinion concerning the propriety or the impropriety of such feelings. I am merely telling you what happened to the Paul Reveres, who were in 1932 a force to be reckoned with in the life of this country. I shall merely add that you must not judge 1932 by the present. In 1932, there was virtually no anti-Jewish sentiment in the United States. But even so, in 1932, the question whether or not Colonel Hadley had dared to criticize Jews became for some of the Paul Reveres the most important question that had been asked since the creation of the world. Was the Colonel guilty? Not in his books, which I have read, probably in some of his public speeches, and certainly, according to my information, in private conversations. But that does not really matter. What does matter is that the beautiful and accomplished young lady, who was really the soul of the Paul Reveres, became convinced that the Colonel did indeed hold sentiments unfavorable to the Jews, and her heart went out in sympathy to that unfortunate people that has been persecuted by all the nations among whom they have settled for thousands of years. The young lady felt, since she was a young lady of very high and conscientious principles, she felt that she could not be associated with a man who entertained in his heart such uncharitable and unreasonable prejudices. She accordingly resigned in protest, and thus what had begun as a tiny crack in one little chapter out in San Diego became a yawning fissure that split the whole organization. Many of the Paul Reveres followed the brilliant young lady out of the organization, some doubtless endorsing her principles, others, we may be sure, paying tribute to her charm and talent.
Some of the members, I do not know what proportion of them, remained with Colonel Hadley. The spirit was gone out of the organization. I'm told that the colonel became both brusque and negligent. The staff of the Home Office in Chicago became both confused and remiss without direction and supervision. Members dropped out when their letters remained unanswered, and no one came to visit their chapters. The Paul Revere's disintegrated as rapidly as a snowman melts down in the spring thaw. No one seems to know the date on which the colonel finally locked up the office and went home. I suspect that he turned the key with a heavy heart. I have given you thus briefly an account of the rise and fall of what in the early 1930s seemed the most vigorous and active anti-communist organization in the nation. That story of disintegration by internal dissent has been repeated, usually on a small scale, but time after time after time in the history of American conservatism. I cannot assure you that the Paul Revere's would have saved the nation if they had not cracked up early in 1933. But had they continued to grow at the rate at which they are said to have grown to the time of their fatal schism, there is a chance they would have done so. By the way, I think I forgot when I was telling you about the Paul Revere's to mention the name of the beautiful and accomplished young lady who had been the real soul of the organization and who resigned in protest against Colonel Hadley's unfortunate and unfounded prejudices. She was Mrs. Elizabeth Dilling. Her friends tell me that since that time she has changed her opinions on some matters. Now, I know how grim and depressing is the outlook for Americans today as the Bolsheviks proceed methodically to take our country away from us by using our money. But frankly, I am more dismayed by the endless bickering and the divisive quarreling within and between so many patriotic organizations. I am dismayed by a tendency that I see among those who consult, quote, public relations experts, unquote, to buy themselves a little cheap publicity by posing as ever so much holier than some other anti-communist organization with whose methods or publications they disagree. I am dismayed by the prevalence of the seductive and fatuous notion that by some such tactic of dissimulation and pretense, a really anti-communist organization can improve its image by getting favorable mention in the New York Times or the People's World, or from the international operators of our national boob tubes. If you are going to worry about what the crypto-communists are going to say about you, or how they distort what you say, you had better say nothing at all. Now, if we are to survive, I suggest that we shall have to think in some very realistic terms. The many able speakers on this program have already told you or will tell you in detail of our progress on the road to the slave labor camps of the Great Society. Tonight, I should like to suggest some necessary background, some very basic considerations which may shock some of you by their crudity and heartlessness. I'm sorry to say that that is simply the crudity and the heartlessness of the world into which we have been born and in which we must live, assuming, of course, that we wish to go on living at all. If we intend to survive ourselves and to have a posterity, we shall have to toughen ourselves intellectually by facing some very unpleasant facts. I know they're unpleasant. It would be ever so much nicer if we could pretend that those facts just didn't exist. But I'm going to mention a few of them just the same, and I shall start with one that is independent of the international communist conspiracy, in the sense that it would still represent for us a terrible danger and menace, even if, by some divine miracle, every Bolshevik conspirator in the world were vaporized at dawn tomorrow. Everyone has heard of the so-called population explosion, but everyone seems afraid to think about it. The number of human beings, anatomically human at least, is undoubtedly increasing at an appalling rate. The United States is already overpopulated for optimum life, although no critical reduction in our standard of living would be necessary for the better part of a century if our masters permitted us to remain an independent nation. Although we, the world's white and civilized minority, may perhaps be able to stave off a crisis for a few decades by working harder and ever harder to support our betters and to speed up the rate at which they are breeding, it is perfectly obvious that we, unless we do something unthinkable, must soon be drowned in the flood that we, like the sorcerer's apprentice, started but do not know how to stop. At the present rate, the globe, sometime between 2000 and 2005 AD, that is to say, within 40 years, will be infested by 5 billion anatomically human creatures, the maximum number for which food can be supplied by even the most intensive cultivation. And then, just to keep the globe inhabitable at that bare subsistence level, it will be necessary to kill every year more people than now live in the whole United States. Kill them with either atomic bombs or clubs, as may be most convenient. That is the statistically certain future. Some people talk about averting the crisis by preaching methods of birth control, which, if there were no other objection to them, would be just about as effective as trying to save the sinking Titanic by organizing a bucket brigade. Other people indulge in pipe dreams about some scientific miracle that will double the known means of producing food and so postpone the crisis, postpone it for all of 20 years. No one seems willing to stop a moment and think about what is wrong with the statistics. What is wrong not arithmetically, but humanly? The world is not going to have a population of 5 billion by 2005 AD. It is not going to have that population at any time in the future. Not ever. The one thing that is certain, absolutely certain, is that the population of the world is going to be drastically reduced before the year 2000. The reduction could come through natural causes. It is always possible, far more possible than many people imagine, that next week or next year may bring the onset of a new pestilence that will have a proportional mortality as great as that of the epidemic in the time of the Antonines or the Black Plague of the Middle Ages. Alternatively, the events described in John Christopher's brilliant novel, No Blade of Grass, could become fact instead of fiction at any time. And there are at least 3 other ways, all scientifically possible, in which the world could be partly depopulated in short order by strictly natural forces beyond our control. But if nature does not act, men will. When things became a bit crowded in East Asia, for example, the Huns, and at a later time the Mongols, swept a wide swath through the world as locusts sweep through a wheat field. Wherever they felt the inspiration, they were every bit as efficient as any quantity of hydrogen bombs that you may care to imagine. In the natural course of human events, we shall see in the near future wars of extermination on a scale and of an intensity that your mind will at present refuse to contemplate. The only question will be what peoples will be among the exterminated. This afternoon, Judge Rarick showed you in the course of his excellent speech a good deal of the hogwash about world peace through world law that is evidently being dumped in the laps of all the jurists in the country. Now, the people who are writing that bunkum are very well aware that there is not going to be any world peace through any world law. They are writing with a full awareness that the population of the earth is increasing beyond the earth's capacity to support it. What they presumably mean by world law is some means of reducing the population very rapidly. Maybe that is what is known as law now by modern definition. It used to be called massacre, but then, of course, I am old-fashioned and learned the English language before it was revised by intellectuals. If the minority of the Earth's inhabitants that is capable of creating and continuing, as distinct from Eti, a high civilization, is exterminated, as it now seems resolved to be, or if for some other reason wars of extermination fail to solve the problem, civilization will collapse from sheer lack of brains to keep it going, and the consequent reversion to global savagery will speedily take care of the excess in numbers. In a world of savages, not only would the intricate and hated technology of our civilization be abolished, but even the simplest arts might be forgotten. Any anthropologist can tell you of tribes in Polynesia and Melanesia that forgot how to make canoes, although without them it became almost impossible to obtain the fish that they regarded as the most delicious food. And of other tribes that forgot how to make bows and arrows, although they needed them for both effective hunting and effective fighting. A world of savages in the year 2100 probably would not have a population more numerous than the world had in 4000 BC. Now, whether you like it or not, and I certainly don't expect you to like it, the next 40 years, which lie within the possible lifetime of some of us here, and certainly within the possible lifetime of our children, will see the extermination in one way or another of a large part of the world's population. The only question before us is whether we choose to be among the exterminated. If we intend to survive, we shall have to use, and use rationally and willingly, our great technological genius and all the truly scientific knowledge about the nature of the world that we have been able to attain. I am speaking now about scientific knowledge, not the pseudo-scientific tripe that is so generally used in public schools and in the colleges to stuff and pervert the minds of the young. I shall mention, therefore, one area that is fundamental to an understanding of human problems: the science of genetics. That, by the way, is the newest of the separate scientific disciplines. And this year we should be observing the centennial of its foundation by an obscure, humble, and too modest Augustinian monk, Father Johann Gregor Mendel. Father Mendel's book, it was the Versuche über Pflanzen Hybriden, was published in 1866. Practically no notice was taken of it. The famous professors in the great universities could not take a mere priest seriously, certainly not a priest so impudent as to contradict Darwin. And so they went on for decades pawing over problems that Father Mendel had made as obsolete as the epicycles of Ptolemaic astronomy. He was simply ignored and forgotten until 1900. When three distinguished biologists discovered independently and almost simultaneously some of the laws that he had ascertained and formulated. It required some time for systematic study of genetics to get underway, and research has been greatly impeded by two catastrophic world wars and by the obscurantism of communists and liberal intellectuals. In Russia and other territories controlled by the conspiracy, Marx's idiotic mumbo-jumbo is official doctrine, and the study of genetics is officially prohibited. There are, however, some indications that research may be going on secretly, And it is even possible that so far as human genetics are concerned, the knowledge thus obtained may exceed our own. For the Soviets, though usually inept in scientific work, have facilities for experiments that civilized men cannot perform. In the mid-1930s, for example, there were reports that experiment stations in Asiatic Russia had pens of human women whom the research workers were trying to breed with male apes in the hope of producing a species better adapted to life under socialism than human beings. It was reported a few years ago that the Soviet is now trying to create subhuman mutations by exposing their human breeding stock to various forms of irradiation. There was, you may recall, a report that one such creature was found on the outskirts of Tibet. Unfortunately, it was said that it was not feasible to bring the specimen down for examination by a reasonable number of competent observers. So one can't tell. But one cannot exclude the possibility that the monsters who conduct such experiments may incidentally find some significant data. Despite the restraints placed on scientific investigation, and despite the awesome complexity of genetic factors in so complicated a creature as man, it is now virtually certain that all of the physiological structure of human beings, including such details as the color of their eyes, the acuity of their vision, their stature, their susceptibility to specific diseases, their reaction to specific drugs, and the formation of their brain, are genetically determined beyond possibility of modification or alteration, except by physical injury or chemical damage. Some of the processes involved have been well ascertained. Others remain unknown. No one knows, for example, why the introduction of minute quantities of fluorine into drinking water will prevent development of the brain in some children, and so roughly double the number of Mongolian idiots born in a given area. That, however, is a statistically ascertained fact. You must not be astonished that the Bureau of Health, Education, and Welfare is sponsoring fluoridation, because the more Mongolian idiots we have, why, the easier it will be to have a needed expansion in the welfare program. It is far more difficult to investigate intellectual capacities, since these must involve a large number of distinct elements, no one of which can be physically observed. But all of the evidence thus far available indicates that intelligence is as completely and unalterably determined by genetic inheritance as physical traits. Moral qualities are even more elusive than intellectual capacity. There is evidence which makes it seem extremely probable that criminal instincts, at least, are inherited. But beyond this, we could only speculate by drawing an analogy between moral and intellectual potentialities. Many persons find the conclusions that I have suggested unpleasant, just as all of us, I am sure, would be much happier if the earth were the immobile center of the universe and the heavens revolved about it. But although vast areas in the new science of genetics remain unexplored, and although the complexity of many problems is such that we cannot hope to know in our lifetime many of the things that we most urgently need to know, the principles of heredity have been determined with a fairly high degree of scientific probability. They are, furthermore, in accord with what common sense has always told us, and also with that rational perception of our place in the universe that underlies religion. We can blind children, but we cannot give them sight. We can stump their minds in progressive schools, but we cannot give them an intelligence they did not inherit at birth. It is likely that we can make criminals of them by putting them, like the somewhat improbable Oliver Twist, in Fagin's gang or its equivalent, but probably we cannot induce a moral sense in one who was born without it. We have always known that it is easy for man to destroy what he can never create. The Mendelian laws, and hence the finding that human beings physically and intellectually at least, are absolutely limited to the potentialities they have inherited, which may be impaired by external action but cannot be increased, are the accepted basis of all serious biological study today. From the standpoint of scientific opinion, to deny heredity is about equivalent to insisting that the earth is flat or that tadpoles spring from the hair of horses. All men are created unequal. And there is nothing that we can do about that. That is the law of life, and we had better recognize it. The Bolsheviks secretly understand and use the scientific knowledge that they would conceal from us in the schools. Why do you suppose that most states now have legislation to subsidize and accelerate the breeding of bastards, of whom at least 95% are the offspring of the very dregs of the population, the shiftless, the irresponsible, the stupid, the degenerate? Why so large a part of your income is stolen by the federal government and devoted to the stimulation in every conceivable way of the hideous fecundity of the unfit, the criminal, and the imbecile elements in our already excessive population? It is not merely to produce a voting majority of parasites to keep criminals in power by strictly democratic means at the polls. It is more than that. They are preparing replacements for us. There is another unpleasant fact, painful to the tender-minded, that you could deduce from the laws of heredity, but it is also conclusively established by direct observation and many other data. Unlike genetics, this is a fact so obvious that rational men have always known it, and no one doubted it until the Bolsheviks gained control of our schools and began to teach to our children as impudent a falsehood as has ever been perpetrated in this world. That is the natural and unalterable difference, and therefore inequality, of races. The observed differences, physical, mental, and instinctive, are in fact so great that proponents of the doctrine of biological evolution have found it simply impossible to trace the five primary races back to a single human type. To account for the biological differences between races in evolutionary terms, it is necessary to assume the existence of different species of pre-human anthropoids. In other words, to conclude that racial differences antedate humanity and the earliest kind of life that can be called human. For the reasons why the observed differences are too great to permit the hypothesis of a single human ancestor, I refer you to Professor Carlton S. Coon's The Origin of Races, first published in 1962. Professor Coon is one of the most distinguished anthropologists in the world, but the Bolsheviks and liberals, who, as you know, are always great champions of the doctrine of academic freedom, were so naturally incensed by his temerity in disclosing facts that must be kept from their slave population in the United States that they organized a spitting campaign against him, with the result that his health was broken and he had to retire prematurely from the University of Pennsylvania. Now, I have mentioned some of the basic biological realities of the world in which we live. They're doubtless regrettable, but they are unalterable. If you find them intolerable and unthinkable, the only thing that I can suggest is that you try to flag down a flying saucer and take passage for some other solar system. Conditions may be different in the region of Alpha Centauri, which is only 4 light years away, but then again, they may not. The only thing which we must not do is to follow the standard liberal procedure imagine a nice dream world in which the laws of nature do not operate, and then, like children playing games in their nursery, pretend that we are living in it. Such infantilism is simply suicidal. At the risk of shocking you further, I shall point out that if we intend to survive, we shall have to do something to bring do-gooding under control. We now regard it, I know, as a kind of amiable weakness, something like alcoholism, and even take pride in some of its manifestations. When a puckish reporter in New York several years ago experimented by solemnly telling people with an unwinking stare that he was collecting money to buy clothes for Cinderella, he obtained, as I remember, about $140 in 2 hours. I suspect that many of us who saw his whimsical report felt a kind of satisfaction in it as proof of our national generosity. We may not be very bright, but we've sure got hearts of gold. We think of do-gooders as mildly amusing, like Mrs. Jellyby in Dickens' Bleak House. We all know what happens, especially in women's clubs, when some niching reformer turns up and administers a few doses of verbal hooch. Pretty soon, the girls begin to see pink elephants on the walls and world peace around the corner. And in a little while, they're out painting the town red with social reform. That's probably harmless enough, but in its more serious aspects, do-gooding is a self-indulgence and luxury that an embattled nation can ill afford. We ever stop to consider the enormous havoc and ruin that has been wrought in this world by earnest do-gooders? Sometimes under stimulus from experts, to be sure, but earnest nevertheless. I know there are many who believe that John Dewey was a conscious member of the international conspiracy, but I'm inclined to believe that he was not. I attach great weight to the testimony of Dewey's grandson, Thornton Dewey, a man for whom I have a great respect. And Mr. Thornton Dewey tells us that his grandfather was really actuated by idealistic considerations. He saw that most people throughout life are worried and unhappy. So he decided to use the schools to make the United States, as Mr. Thornton Dewey puts it, quote, a nation of happy, grinning idiots. Quote. That's reasonable enough. Everyone knows that chimpanzees have no worries. They shed no tears. Give a chimpanzee a banana and you have made him happy all day. So you see, if you could make American children as nearly like chimpanzees as possible, teach them that life is just a series of animal satisfactions, think of all the sorrow and unhappiness that you will be sparing the dear children. Think how much good you will have done. We all know what John Dewey's gang, the one for which he at least provided the pretext, whatever he may have thought he was doing, have done to our country. The United States was lost. It was lost in the schoolrooms, beginning back in 1918, when a schoolteacher at Boston, Marion Sproul, as I remember, told us, give us one generation of children to train and we will have a Soviet in the United States. She meant it in 1918. Few of us believed her. Now, I know that Woodrow Wilson was a pliant tool in the hands of those who selected him and boosted him into the presidency, especially Colonel House and Jakob Schiff. But he is reported to have exclaimed before his death, God forgive me, I have unwittingly ruined my country. If he felt that remorse, he cannot have been entirely cynical and evil. He probably did have some of the characteristic hallucinations of do-gooders. He may actually have believed that there could be such a thing as a war to end wars and to make the world safe for democracy. If so, those figments of his imagination sent 115,000 of our best men to a useless death and inflicted on another 200,000 painful wounds, maiming many of them for life. Is that a proper price to ask a nation to pay just because some muzzy-headed dreamer feels an itch to save the world at our expense? Our own history provides us with a far more terrible example in the strange breed that flourished in New England a little more than a century ago. It was another grim appearance in history of the old delusions of Gnosticism. And some of the leading exponents were the loquacious individuals who called themselves Transcendentalists, although Edgar Allan Poe more accurately described them as the Frogpondians, and some less courteous contemporaries called them the Crazyites. The Transcendentalists were not a formally organized cult. As a group, they were as diffuse as is the nebula in Orion, which the center is conspicuous, while the outer edges are so tenuous and obscure that it has no precise boundaries. But the glowing center shows that this cloud was formed by what Eric Vogelin calls the metastatic will to transform reality by means of fantasy. The Transcendentalists revolted against Christianity and also against human reason. They made no serious effort to observe facts and reason from them. Instead, they trusted to their intuition. That is to say, they felt themselves inflated and uplifted by vague and expansive sensations, which they attributed to their souls instead of dyspepsia. Naturally, they felt inspired to remodel the universe, and they chatted endlessly about social reform. The more feverish flocked together at Brook Farm to start heaven on earth, with the antics that Hawthorne described with very considerable attenuation in the Blithedale Romance. The Transcendentalists, who naturally learned nothing from even so recent an event as the French Revolution, had Rousseauistic hallucinations. They believed in the wickedness of society and in the innate goodness and hence perfectibility of man. Now, that was not quite like believing that the moon is made of green cheese, for after all, no one could go to the moon and find out. That was like believing that the ocean is made of maple syrup. The auto-intoxication of the Transcendentalists gave rise to a dark fanaticism. A good example was the Reverend Theodore Parker, who, after repudiating the authority of the Christian scriptures and all tradition, talked much about the, quote, higher law, unquote, which supersedes all others. The American author J.C. Furness has neatly summarized the crux of that doctrine. How may one learn the law of God? Though never quite explicit, the reply is always clear. Just apply to the one man, hieratic Supreme Court, that through God's inscrutable choice consists of the Reverend Theodore Parker. Parker's God was just the elongated shadow of the Reverend Parker's distended ego. If he was unaware of that, he was suffering from one of the most pernicious delusions that can afflict the human mind. In religious terms, it was the sin of Lucifer. In human terms, it was madness. It is not astonishing, therefore, that Parker was a member of the band of conspirators who called themselves the Secret Six, and used as their instrument that distinguished horse thief and homicidal maniac, John Brown, whom liberals so much admire for his ferocity. You will find a good account of the conspiracy in Furness's book, The Road to Harper's Ferry. The book, incidentally, contains an actual photograph of Brown. which clearly shows the diseased creature's face, and in juxtaposition, the propaganda pictures drawn by his supporters to make him look like a benign Moses. As we all know, Brown was inspired by the great civil rights movement in Haiti in the early part of that century. A great movement in which all white men, women, and children were systematically butchered, and many of them were eaten. Brown, like the more enthusiastic civil writers of today, hoped that he could get a few million white women raped and a few million white men hacked into little pieces in the United States. His attempted insurrection, of course, was as insane as his proclamation of a new constitution of the United States, under which he appointed himself commander-in-chief of the provisional government. But it shows that his intentions were good, by liberal standards, that is. Brown, as I have said, was encouraged and financed by the Secret Six, all of whom, including a person reputed to be the wealthiest landowner in the United States, later claimed that they didn't have the slightest idea of what they were encouraging and financing him to do. Well, let's give the Reverend Parker the benefit of the doubt. But we all know how much his kind had to do with forcing on the South the desperate war for independence that ended so tragically. Tragically for the South and eventually for the whole nation just a century ago. We all know the history of that bloody and terrible war, of the many battles that left whole countrysides drenched with the best blood of our race, of the almost unbelievable valor and courage shown on both sides. And although many forces worked to precipitate that horribly internecine conflict, we all know that it probably would not have occurred but for the wild antics and yelling of those monomaniac fanatics, the abolitionists. Now, I fully understand that throughout history, especially perhaps in the United States, slavery has been a baneful and pernicious institution, most baneful indeed in its effect on the owners. I do have a deep sympathy and compassion for the Negroes. There were 4 billion of them at that time in our land. And I regret that their lot was not in the least alleviated by the vast slaughter and ruin that has indelibly stained the pages of our history. But I wonder that anyone can read that history without being stirred to the depths of his being with admiration for the men who fought and died, and without asking himself whether they were not too great a price to pay. Bismarck was not a humanitarian. He did not pretend to be one. It was purely as a matter of practical politics that he once said that a German colony was not worth the bones of one Prussian grenadier. And let our compassion for the slaves and even our liking for their race be as great as you will. I could only marvel if any man can find it in his heart to say that their emancipation was worth the lives of just one company of men in any one of the regiments from Virginia or from Minnesota that met at Shiloh, Chickamauga, or Gettysburg. No race can afford much do-gooding on that scale. Now, there is another fact of life that everyone knows but many people try to ignore, and that is the prevalence of innate evil in the human species, including, I am sorry to say, all races. If you are a Christian, you have divine authority for the perception of how terribly extensive, pervasive, and powerful in this world is the domain of evil, pure evil. If you are not, you must follow some doctrine of biological evolution, and you will find that the real mystery is how it happened that men, any man, became thoughtful and kind. Civilization is only a little more than 5,000 years old, and 5,000 years is a mere moment in biological time. it is perfectly obvious that the genetic stock of every race must contain innumerable genes that persist from primeval savagery, and that even the most cultivated and refined society must produce beings whose lust for evil is doubtless stronger than any man's desire for good. Have you ever stopped to think what would happen in any city if the police were really as ineffectual as Earl Warren would like to make them? Have you ever considered the biological source of the many crimes that are committed, even in the best police societies, for no other motive than the pleasure, the sheer pleasure of committing them, for the joys of brutality, the joys of evil for its own sake? There are many such crimes that no one remembers. The newspapers mention them briefly, if at all, in veiled language. And the reader forgets before the next morning what should have been for him a sobering lesson in the nature of the world in which he lives. There are a few crimes that have attained an adventitious notoriety. One still thinks of Loeb and Leopold in Chicago, of Harman in Germany, Vache in France, of Princess Belgioso in Italy, and a few others. Some of you may remember the well-known cannibal of Washington, D.C., Albert Fish. He was very fond of children, so fond of them that he kidnapped and ate about 15 of them, after first mutilating and torturing them in various ways. He was captured in 1935, and, this will distress the bleeding hearts, since Earl Warren was not on the Supreme Court at that time, Fish was executed. Incidentally, true to type, he professed noble purposes. Now, creatures like that are produced in much larger numbers than you would like to believe. Biologically, you can explain them as examples of either atavism or degeneration, but you dare not ignore them if you are going to understand the nature of the world in which you live. For if you do not understand the Gilles de Rais, the Marquis de Sade, Loeb and Leopold, Harman, Fish and their kind, you cannot understand Bolsheviks. The best illustration, so far as I know, of the basic mentality and instincts of the Bolsheviks is to be found in Louis Zuhl's excellent study of an identical phenomenon in India, what is called Thuggee, the secret conspiracy of thugs that flourished until the British imperialists, by using the necessarily drastic measures, suppressed it in the 19th century. I recommend Louis Zuhl's Thugs and Communists to you. It is available in any American opinion bookstore. I published a short commentary on that book in American Opinion in January 1962, and my first thought was to try to summarize those conclusions tonight. But since we began by mentioning anti-communist organizations that were active in the early 1930s, let me mention the International Legion Against Communism, of which the commander was an American military hero, Major Frank Pease. He accurately described the essence of the communist conspiracy in a little booklet entitled Campfires of Genghis, published by the Legion in 1933. I was first able to obtain a copy about a year ago, but if you can find one, I recommend it highly. For Major Pease knew in 1933 what we must all learn. Permit me to quote a central passage. There is a deep-seated, an inexpugnable, a deliberately cultivated and inappeasable sadism in the very nature of communism. In that mad phantasmagoria of envy, hatred, lust for power, and megalomania, which has bitten so deeply into every left-wing irreconcilable on earth since the Russian Revolution, in that insane mixture of class hostility, inferiority complex, and unconcealed brutality
which, God save the mark, passes with communists for revolutionary idealism. In that, sadism is the ever-present underlying note. It punctuates all their speeches, taints their every pronunciamento, is the animus of all their laws, even their most impersonal so-called economic legislation. It is always aimed at something, intended to injure, crush, and destroy someone. It bears the characteristic stigmata of all homicidal maniacs and sadists, the very mark of the beast. Consequently, not even the hordes of Genghis and Islam shall it equal in frenzy and lust, in depravity and hate, that scourge of sadistic destruction for its own sake, which communism's red armies will wreak upon the world. A hated bourgeois world. That is most to the rest of us. In the worst of men, communism calls out the worst, the very worst. Its malicious, soul-frightening subversions reach deep into those hidden lacunae of the darkest past, where slumber the ferocities of mutilation and torture. The diabolical joys of slaughter unleashed, of vandalism and of anarchy, the dark sports of prehistoric cavemen and troglodytes. At all the crossways of the world, China, India, Persia, Java, Indochina, and the Philippines, as well as in the back alleys and smoldering ghettos of our metropolis, communism has already set innumerable singers and sirens, calling up unspeakable hungers and indescribable rapacities, a fearful call to all the dark powers of the earth. Already communism smacks its lips for the blood feast of tomorrow. By these red canaille, sadism has been made a very creed. A perverted politico-economic murder cult. A world's quest for the lusts of mayhem and assassination. This nameless abomination is the same old evil from the depths that has wrecked the world more times than you have years to your life. The highways of history are but the spoor of its passing, clotted with dead peoples, dead nations, with dust heaps of empires and ruined republics, crushed by its fury. It wrecked massive Egypt, graceful Greece, and great Rome. It will wreck this modern world, your world, unless you behead it, crush it, then be the blood and doom upon your own heads. Or if not yours, then certainly those of your children, for blood and doom are the essence of communism. That was true in 1933. That is true today. We did nothing in 1933 when we could with ease have put our heel on the head of the still puny serpent. Perhaps we shall do nothing today when our backs are almost against the wall. Let me conclude with one further comment on what I have tried to say. When the Bolsheviks pay jackals snarl at us, they usually hiss racist and white supremacist. Let me make it clear, therefore, that I am not arguing for the superiority of the white race. I am asking a question, a biological question. Have we, the men of the West, who are a small minority among the world's inhabitants, we who are the sole creators of a civilization whose technology gives us absolute mastery of the world if we want it, we whose Christian civilization, for all its many, many defects, is, in comparison with others, as superior morally as it is technologically, have we lost the will to live?
That is a question that any observer must ask when he sees the incredible spectacle of a great nation taxing itself to nourish cannibals, draining away its economic blood to arm the Bolshevik beasts, tolerating in its own midst the systematic breeding with its own money of degeneracy and crime. Have our minds become so befuddled and paralyzed by the hypocritical jabbering of unhuman invaders and the babbling of our own fools that we have lost even the instinct of self-preservation?
If indeed we have, then by the irrevocable law of nature, we have become like the dinosaurs, the dodos, and the mountain gorillas. Biologically obsolete, and the world will soon know us no more.